Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, Ana Mateo will have this week's health report. Later, we will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, the Supreme Court of the United States is preparing to hear arguments involving President Donald Trump's immigration policies. The court meets Wednesday to consider whether Trump's 2017 restrictions on travel and immigration from some countries are legal. The measures mostly affect people from Iran, Libya, Somalia, Syria, and Yemen. Visitors from North Korea and Venezuela also were affected, but the two countries are not part of the case. Whatever the High Court decides, the restrictions have already shaped the lives of many people. Radad Albarati came to the United States from Yemen over 20 years ago when he was a teenager. He became a U.S. citizen in 2010. Today, Albarati lives in New York City and works at night in a small store. But his wife remains in Yemen. She and her husband have known each other since they were children. For years, he has tried to bring her and their three sons to New York. Last autumn, when U.S. courts temporarily blocked the travel restrictions, Albarati was able to get visas for his sons. The boys came to New York. But his wife was not permitted to travel with them. The U.S. Embassy in Yemen said in a letter that she was not eligible for a visa. And it said the decision could not be appealed. In other words, she should not ask again. Now the family is waiting to hear what the Supreme Court says. The boys, ages 10 to 16, live with three separate sets of family friends because Albarati worries about them being alone while he works. Albarati also worries about his wife. She is back in Yemen, where more than 10,000 people have died in fighting over the past 3 years. Albarati says he understands that U.S. government policymakers want to keep the country safer. But he says, separating families, that is sick. The president's goal for the travel ban was not to separate families. Trump said he aimed to keep radical Islamic terrorists out of the country. Other people connected to Trump's administration have made similar comments. James Carafano helped the administration in its early days. He is a national security expert at the Heritage Foundation, a public policy group based in Washington, D.C. Carafano says the travel restrictions resulted from concerns that Islamic State fighters could target the United States. He said the threat was real, and policymakers were answering the risk. He said, "What do we need to do to protect the nation, and what do we need to do to help people who need help, and what is the balance? We do the best we can. State Department officials have said that the restrictions aim to urge foreign governments to share information and to protect the U.S. until they do. But critics of the ban say the policy is a form of illegal discrimination based on religion and nationality. They point out that most people affected by the restrictions are from countries that are mostly Muslim. And they recall Trump's words while he was a candidate for president. He called for a total and complete shutdown of Muslims entering the United States. U.S. officials will not discuss any individual cases, but the restrictions are felt by individuals. Payam Iafari is another example. He is from Iran, but had a student visa to study at the Academy of Art University in San Francisco. Iafari says that he wanted to visit his family in Tehran last summer and celebrate earning his master's degree in filmmaking. But he did not make the trip. He said he could not risk going home in case the immigration policy changes again. He is still in California, seeking a career in the film industry, but missing his family. The separation and uncertainty is especially hard on his mother. In an email, she wrote, "Waiting for what will happen in the end, this is very difficult for a mother." His sister noted, "Politics treats everyone in the world's lives like toys. We all get burned in the end." Abdusalan Mohamed Jelle and his wife are from Somalia. Their country has been at war for more than 25 years. Jelle came to the United States in 2007 and became a citizen 5 years later. He lives in Minnesota with his two young sons, ages 7 and 4. But his wife remains in Africa. She was delayed in coming to the U.S. until she could get a passport for her newborn daughter. Then her visa expired. She has not been given another one. Jelle says the boys sometimes ask when their mother is coming. "Soon, soon," he says. But he does not know the real answer. He is struggling to care for his sons while he works full-time and studies to earn his high school degree. He says, "I love this country because we have a lot of opportunity, education, health, peace. I live here. I want to live here. But if my wife, she lives in Nairobi, sometimes I'm thinking I've moved back to Africa." We'll be right back.
From VOA Learning English, this is the Health and Lifestyle Report. If you have been meaning to add more exercise to your daily routine, you may want to start sooner rather than later. A 2018 study has found that a lifetime of regular exercise and activity can slow down the aging process. Researchers at Britain's University of Birmingham and King's College London say that getting older should not necessarily mean becoming more weak or sick. Their research shows that a commitment to a life of movement and exercise may help us live not only longer, but also healthier. For their study, the researchers looked at two groups. The first group was made up of 125 non-professional cyclists between the ages of 55 to 79. This group included 84 healthy men and 41 healthy women. We will call this group the cyclists. Researchers then found 130 people to make up a second group. Within this group, 75 people were aged 57 to 80. The other 55 were between the ages of 20 and 36. The people in this group were also healthy, but they did not exercise regularly. We will call this group the non-exercisers. Smokers, heavy drinkers of alcohol, and people with other health issues were not included in the study. Then researchers gave both groups a series of tests. They tested their muscle mass, muscular strength, percentage of body fat, cholesterol levels, and the strength of their immune systems. And male participants had their testosterone levels checked. Then the researchers compared the results of the two groups. Results showed that the cyclists did not experience body changes usually equated with a normal aging process. For example, they did not lose muscle mass or strength. Also, their body fat and cholesterol levels did not increase with age. The male cyclists' testosterone levels had also remained high. Researchers say this may mean that they avoided at least one major symptom of male menopause. The researchers also found something they had not expected. The study showed that the immune systems of the cyclists did not seem to age either. For this, they looked at an organ called the thymus. The thymus makes immune cells called T cells. The University of Arizona's biology department explains on its website that T cells are a type of white blood cell and are made in our bone marrow. As the article says, there are two types of T cells in your body: helper T cells and killer T cells. Killer T cells do the work of destroying the infected cells. The helper T cells coordinate the attack. Starting at about the age of 20, the thymus of most people starts to get smaller. It also starts to make fewer T cells. However, in this study, the T cell production by the thymuses of the cyclists had not slowed down with age. They were making as many T cells as those of a young person. Janet Lord is director of the Institute of Inflammation and Aging at the University of Birmingham. In a press statement, she offers the words of Hippocrates, often called the father of medicine. She writes, "Hippocrates in 400 BC said that exercise is man's best medicine. But his message has been lost over time,
and we are an increasingly sedentary society. Professor Stephen Herridge is director of the Center of Human and Aerospace Physiological Sciences at King's College London. He addressed the common question of what came first, the chicken or the egg. In this case, the question became, which came first, the healthy behavior or the good health? When talking about the findings of the study, he said, the cyclists do not exercise because they are healthy, but that they are healthy because they have been exercising for such a large portion of their lives. The researchers advise us all to find an exercise that we like and to make physical activity a priority in our lives. They published their findings in Aging Cell. The study is part of ongoing research by the two universities. And that's the Health and Lifestyle Report. I'm Ana Mateo.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. President James Garfield was shot and seriously wounded in the summer of 1881. The man who shot him said he supported the political group that supported Vice President Chester Arthur. The gunman was found to be insane. But some people were ready to believe the worst about Vice President Arthur. They knew that many of the Vice President's political allies disliked President Garfield. They thought the Vice President might have helped the gunman in some way. Harry Monroe and Kay Gallant tell what happened after President Garfield was shot.
For a time, it seemed the president might get better. But the bullet wound became infected. He died of the infection 2 months after he was shot. Vice President Arthur took the oath of office a few hours after the president's death. Chester Arthur had been a successful lawyer. He had worked in politics for a number of years, but he had never before held an elected office. Many Americans questioned his ability to serve in the White House. One person put it this way: Chet Arthur, President of the United States? Good God!
Almost everyone feared Arthur would be a tool of a Republican Party leader in New York, Roscoe Conkling. They were sure Conkling would be the real power in Arthur's administration. They were wrong. Chester Arthur surprised everyone. He broke all his ties with the Conkling political machine. He remained independent of any party group. Arthur asked Garfield's cabinet to resign. He chose new men for all but one department.
In his first message to Congress, President Arthur asked for changes in the way government jobs were filled. He proposed a new civil service system that would let ability, not politics, decide who got government jobs. Republican Party leaders opposed these proposals. The civil service system would stop them from giving federal jobs to their supporters. It would destroy much of their power. These Republican leaders controlled Congress. They refused to act on the civil service proposals.
Civil service reform, however, was an important issue. President Garfield had been assassinated by a man who believed he should have gotten a government job because of his politics. Also, new cases of dishonesty had been discovered in the post office department. The public began to demand laws to clean up the civil service. In 1882, a new Congress was elected. The new Congress was controlled by the Democratic Party. President Arthur again appealed for civil service reform. This time, he got results. The new Congress passed a civil service bill that required 10% of all federal jobs to be filled through competitive examinations. This 10% included half the officials in the post office department. It included most workers at federal customs houses. The bill also said it was illegal for politicians to ask government employees for campaign money, and it set up a civil service committee to enforce the new law.
President Arthur also found himself faced with an unusual problem. The government was earning more money than it needed. Most of the money came from tariffs, taxes on imports. Each year, tariffs brought in $100 million more than the government needed. The import taxes had been set high to protect American industries from foreign competition. President Arthur wanted to reduce the tariffs. Congress wanted to keep them high. Industrial leaders wanted to keep them high, too. They did not want to compete with low-priced foreign products.
Congress saw no problem with the extra money brought in by high tariffs. It found many ways to spend it. For example, Congress raised payments to soldiers who had fought in the Civil War during the 1860s. It also approved money to build roads, bridges, and waterways throughout the country. Many of these things were not needed. They were approved for political purposes. They put government money into the home areas of powerful congressmen. In 1882, Congress passed the Rivers and Harbors Bill. The bill would cost almost $19 million. President Arthur vetoed the bill. He said it would waste too much money, but Congress passed the bill into law over his veto.
Next, President Arthur urged Congress to form a committee to find a way to reduce tariffs. Congress formed the committee. The committee proposed that tariffs be reduced by 20%. But Congress did not consider the proposal when it began debating a new tariff bill. President Arthur was more successful in getting Congress to reduce the public debt. During his term, the debt was cut by more than $400 million.
Chester Arthur's efforts for honest government and lower taxes won him much support among the people, but he could not win the support of his Republican Party. Arthur wanted to serve another 4 years in the White House. His name was put before the Republican nominating convention in 1884. The name of Senator James Blaine of Maine also was put before the convention. On the first ballot, Blaine received 334 votes. Arthur got only 278. Three ballots later, Blaine won the presidential nomination. However, many Republicans refused to support Blaine. They accused him of being dishonest. They said he was controlled by powerful politicians.
The Democratic Party chose New York Governor Grover Cleveland as its presidential candidate. Like Chester Arthur at the national level, Grover Cleveland was known for fighting dishonesty in government at the local level. He began as mayor of the city of Buffalo, New York. He cleaned up the city government and saved the taxpayers much money. Next, he was elected governor of New York State. There, too, he helped end dishonesty in government. Cleveland refused to give jobs to Democrats because of their political ties. Instead, he filled state jobs with men of ability. This early success helped him win the Democratic presidential nomination.
The campaign of 1884 between Republican Blaine and Democrat Cleveland was one of the most bitter in American political history. A group of Republicans who opposed Blaine published letters to prove he was dishonest. Blaine had written the letters several years earlier during a shameful incident concerning the sale of railroad stock. Now, he was forced to defend himself against those old charges.
Blaine's supporters fought back by discovering a scandal in Cleveland's past. Grover Cleveland had never married, but more than 10 years earlier, he had been involved with a young woman. The woman gave birth to a boy. Cleveland was not sure the boy was his son, but he accepted responsibility for the child. He sent money to help care for him. A Republican newspaper published the story. Soon, Republican crowds were shouting a joke about it. "Ma, Ma, where's my pa?" "Gone to the White House. Ha, ha, ha."
Both candidates campaigned hard. It was clear to everyone that the vote would be close. Election day was cold and rainy. Early results showed the two candidates with almost the same number of electoral votes. The winner would be the one who captured a majority of the popular votes in New York State. That candidate would then get all of New York's electoral votes. It was not until 3 days after the voting that election officials announced Cleveland had won. His victory set off wild celebrations among Democrats across the country. Grover Cleveland really was going to the White House. Ha, ha, ha. His election would bring some important changes to the country.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.